You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Mike Papantonio is going to be with us in the second hour of our program. And we've got an interesting day. And there's a bunch of interesting things in the news. In the 10 years we've been doing this show, a lot of people have passed away, and I've discussed it with you on the air. In fact, many of them, from my cat to my father and my mother, to our friend Michael Hutchison, who was on the program fairly frequently, and just a profound mystic, and my mentor Gottfried Mueller, who started the International Salem Programs, who asked us to all have a party when he passed away. He said, "I'm going into the light. You have a good time and celebrate my life and celebrate the fact that I'm in a really good place now." So, you know, with that, from that place, I just want to note that Fred Phelps, the guy who started the Westboro Baptist Church and who used to show up at military funerals and everything else with these signs that said, "God hates fags." And years ago, when he was really in his heyday, we actually launched a website titled GodHatesFigs.org and .com. In fact, I think I just let it roll back into the public domain a couple of weeks ago, in large part because, you know, they're just, it's passé now. And my point was that there's four or five different places in the New Testament and a couple of dozen in the Old Testament where God smites fig trees, or where Jesus smites a fig tree. There's no place that I can find in the Bible where God smites anybody who's gay. So I was operating on the assumption that Fred Phelps was simply doing his life's work based on a typographic error. But, you know, funny or not, it's an interesting, thought-provoking moment. And Nate Phelps is with us. He is the son, or a son, of Fred Phelps. He's, in his own right, he's a speaker, an author on religion and child abuse, an advocate for LGBT causes. He is the estranged son of the Westboro Baptist Church's founder, Pastor Fred Phelps. His website, by the way, is Nate Phelps, NatePhelps.com. And it's a fascinating website. I encourage you to check it out. Nate, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. First of all, I want to offer my condolences on the passing of your father. Even though you were estranged, it still must be a difficult thing for you.
Yeah, I appreciate that, sir.
I don't know if I can compare it to how I felt when my dad died or not, but your thoughts on your father's life and death?
On his life?
Yeah.
I think that I can boil it down to one sentence. I think it was a terrible waste. I think he had the mind. He had the ability to be significantly valuable to society, to his children, to the community. And he chose a direction that ended up being very destructive.
Any idea why?
Well, it's interesting because you go back and look at his youth, and he actually had an appointment to West Point that he was supposed to enter. When he turned 18, he graduated from high school when he was 17. And in that summer before his, summer and fall before his 18th birthday, he went to a revival meeting at the Methodist church that his family, was a member of. Mm-hmm. And he says he had a calling, and he got caught up in, he went to Bob Jones University and got caught up in that whole Calvinist predestination ideology, and the rest is history, as they say.
Yeah, there's been some interesting research over the years into homophobia, and this study has been replicated so many times that it's almost a cliche. But if you hook men, and the studies are a little more ambiguous on women, but women tend not to be outspoken homophobes as much as men. If you hook men up to a device that measures arousal, sexual arousal, physically measures it, and show them gay porn, straight men are not aroused by it. Gay men are aroused by it. But interestingly, there's apparently a fairly small category, maybe 1 or 2% of the population, who are actually and genuinely bisexual. They're aroused by both straight porn and by gay porn. And my experience has been that a lot of the men who have come on this program over the years, and I've had this conversation with several of them, and a couple of them have basically copped to it. You know, I say, how can you say that homosexuality is a choice unless for you it would be a choice? And if for you it would be a choice, then you're probably bisexual. And James Cameron, for example, I had that conversation with, and he all but said so. I don't want to put words in his mouth. And I'm wondering if, and for somebody growing up in the 40s and 50s and 60s, when not only being gay was, you know, a social shame, but it was also a crime in most parts of this country, you can see where somebody, if they felt those tendencies or those attractions, might just go nuts trying to fight it off. It's probably a horrible day to ask you to psychoanalyze your father, but not just him, but the entire movement. I'm curious your thoughts on all that.
Yeah. And I'm torn on that, Tom, because I've had that question asked before. One of the things I committed to when I started talking about what it was like growing up there and the realities of that environment was that I was going to try to be as honest as I could and not draw conclusions where there wasn't evidence. And that's where I'm stuck on this issue. I like you, have seen a lot of people, a lot of outspoken homophobes who ultimately acknowledge their homosexual tendencies, or that, you know, they're flat out homosexual.
Right.
I just don't have any evidence for it.
Yeah.
You know, my father was in the midst of all the violence and the ugliness of growing up there. There wasn't anything there that suggested or specifically pointed to that tendency. He just has always had this attitude in his preaching that it was a that somehow homosexuality was a special kind of sin,
right,
because of his reading of some passage in Romans.
Mm-hmm. So we have just a minute or so left. We're talking with Fred Phelps' dad, or son, Nate Phelps, Fred Phelps has passed away. Any thoughts on your father's passing in this last minute, Nate?
Well, you know, a lot of folks have contacted me and offered their condolences. But I went through this. I left on the night of my 18th birthday, mm-hmm. and haven't seen my father in, you know, 35 years. I went through a deliberate process about 10 years after I left of mourning the loss of my family, because in fact I had lost him because of their strategy of ostracizing people who leave the church. So I have over the years believed that my reaction was going to be virtually non-existent, that I've already experienced this, right? I'm a little surprised that there is some emotion there.
Yeah.
But in the end, my thoughts go to this whole issue. I mean, even though my father's passed, his ideas haven't passed, and we still have that struggle to go through to finally find some equality for the gay community in the United States. So
yeah,
that's
I'm
what
with
my
you.
Focus is right now.
Okay, Nate Phelps, his website, Nate, N-A-T-E Phelps, P-H-E-L-P-S .com. Nate, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
Very thoughtful conversation. Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm curious your thoughts on the passage of Fred Phelps and this whole issue of homophobia in America. What is motivating? Welcome back, Nate. Sweet. international television superstar and producer of The Big Picture, on the line with us. Hey, Nate.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Great. You did a fine job last night on our panel.
Thank you very much.
It was two nights ago on Tuesday night. I haven't had an opportunity to say that to you on the air, and I wanted to do that.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. So what's going on tonight with The Big Picture?
All right, so starting off the show, it's Thursday, so we have Mike Papantonio on. The main thing we're going to be talking about is a Republican, yes, a Republican, spoke out against voter suppression laws in Wisconsin. This guy, Dale Schultz, he's a Wisconsin state senator. He's actually the only Republican to vote against that state's new voter suppression law that's about to be signed by Governor Scott Walker. He ripped into Republicans for pushing voter suppression laws on while he was on a local radio show in Madison earlier this week. So we're going to use that to talk about, have a general discussion with PAP about voting rights and, what's the status of fighting back against the Republican voter suppression war.
Good.
And we'll also be getting PAP's talk on Paul Ryan's, PAP's take on Paul Ryan's racist poverty talk, the ongoing power struggle that's sort of fallen onto the news this week between the CIA and the Senate and Intel Committee, how Obama sort of staying neutral and,
which he pretty much has to do, actually, because the CIA works for him, or the NSA works for him. All of them work for him. You know, on the Paul Ryan thing, did you see the clip where the guy challenged him at a town hall meeting and he said, "I didn't say anything about race"?
Oh, man, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess your excuse is if you use a dog whistle, you're not explicitly talking about race.
Right.
But, I mean, it seemed pretty explicit to me.
Yeah, yeah.
And then in B, we're going to be talking about the ongoing problem of coal ash spills in the country. Just a few weeks after the Big Dan River spill in North Carolina, the Sierra Club says it has evidence that Louisville Gas and Electric in Kentucky has been spilling coal ash, dumping coal ash into the Ohio River, which is obviously a big waterway
for over 2 million people.
Yeah, it's one of the major ones in the United States, and that's a huge deal. And coal ash is incredibly toxic. I mean, the stuff that was going to the Dan River had selenium, arsenic, I think 13 times.
It also has uranium in it. I mean, coal ash is also radioactive, which is usually missed by people.
It's water.
It's very, very lightly radioactive, but it only takes one atom of an actinide of any element on that part of the periodic table inside your body to just sit there and slowly release beta or alpha particles over time, and you're in trouble.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, it's obviously an interesting issue. Who knows how many other plants across the country are dumping their coal ash into our water source. So
probably most.
Yeah, probably most, and, especially in states like North Carolina that have just slashed away their regulatory budgets. So.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully we'll be having Bobby Kennedy maybe to come on and talk about that, or some other environmental expert to really get us the big picture on what's the status of coal.
Then we're going to have a debate about the Hobby Lobby?
Yep. Sherrilyn Harley Lebon, she's a former senior counsel for the Senate Judiciary Committee. She's a co-chair of Project 21. She'll be debating with you about the Hobby Lobby case.
She's been on our program before, hasn't she?
She has. She's been on a couple Rumbles and Politics panels. Okay. She'll be talking about the Hobby Lobby case that's probably going to be decided next week that could have big consequences, not only for Obamacare, but for corporate personhood, depending on how the Supreme Court decides it.
Yeah, yeah, very interesting.
And then C is your take, my take, and D, we have a woman from Australia. Her name is Rebecca Campbell. She's coming out to talk about lying. And then the daily take is about student debt and how it really shows that we've reached the cancer stage of Reaganomics.
There you go. And you're going to get the phones working today.
Hopefully.
Okay. Nate, sweet.
No promises.
Thanks, Nate.
All right.
We'll see you tonight. It's 20 minutes past the hour. By the way, Free Speech TV and their fund drive. Call them now. Okay, when we come back for the next break, I'd be very interested in hearing your thoughts on the life of Fred Phelps. I find this absolutely fascinating that probably one of the most famously hateful men in America, who created this bizarre little cult around him, one of the most famously hateful men in America, has passed away, Fred Phelps. And I think there actually is a fair amount of evidence for this, but whether there's evidence or not, my personal take on death is that no matter who you are, whether you're Fred Phelps or Adolf Hitler or Mother Teresa, that at that moment of death, you have that Michael Hutchison experience that I've shared with you in the past, and you can go over to TomHartmann.com and just plug his name into the search engine. I'm sure it'll come up. It's Hutchison, no N, H-U-T-C-H-I-S-O-N, Michael Hutchison. That experience of just being part of everything, your own personal, individual consciousness, just melting into the light, into the consciousness of absolutely everything that is. And that if you could describe an emotion associated with that or a feeling associated with that, it would be love or ecstasy or joy or oneness or awe or wonder. I mean, all these things. And I think most of us have touched it in various ways at different times in our lives. My mom once described to me how she touched that when she was giving birth to my youngest brother and she actually died, or, you know, she stopped breathing. They revived her. And she just had this, I'm here, I'm part of everything experience. And it's just, so Fred, you know, in my mind, Fred's like part of the light now too. But this issue, and it was very interesting talking with his son, Nate, because I think a lot of folks are operating out of that assumption, that false dichotomy that bisexuals will tell you about, and that I went through a learning curve on this very program about, that there are some straight people, and there are some gay people for that matter, some actually fairly prominent gay spokespeople, who suggest that you're either gay or you're straight. And you're born, basically born that way. But there are some people who are both, you know, who are genuinely born bisexual and can live a happy, straight life, but they always know that if they wanted to become gay, they could. If they wanted to, you know, have a partner who is of the same sex, it would be just as good as having a partner of the opposite sex for them. And when we do analysis, when they analyze people, men, almost all this research has been done on men. When they measure men who are highly homophobic, straight men who hate gays, they are not only aroused by women, but they are also aroused by men, by gay sex or gay porn. And that tells me that they're bisexual. And I think when I asked Nate, you know, could your dad have been like this? He said, well, I never saw any evidence that my dad might have been secretly gay. And he said, and he talked about, you know, some of the people that he had known in the anti-gay movement who actually were gay and were hiding it. But that's really not what I was talking about. And I didn't want to, I mean, his dad died today. I didn't want to get into a whole big thing with him about it. But I think that this is like, this is the place, this homophobic place is occupied almost exclusively, in my opinion and in my experience, by men who are bisexual and can't deal with one half of themselves, if that makes sense. So anyhow, that's my take on that. And I hopefully Fred Phelps' passing will be a milestone, not necessarily a, you know, I what was it, John Donne, you know, every man's death diminishes me, for I am a part of mankind. Each man is a part of the main, you know, therefore ask not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. That kind of, you know, I'm not celebrating his death, but I think that his passing is a moment in time that is one of those stepping stones in the river of time that we're going to look back on and say, you know, that was about the time that America changed. And when you look at other countries where you have leaders who are just out there, I like Uganda, you know, you've got President Museveni now, signing a law that would put gays in prison for life. And you wonder, okay, you know, what's with this guy? How could he possibly think that it's a choice? That being gay is a choice. The only person who could possibly think that is somebody who's bisexual, who could really believe that because of their own personal experience. And that's not to knock people who are bisexual. Some people are very happily bisexual. Anyhow, the other point that I wanted to make, we have seen now the average 25-year-old's debt. If you went back 10 years ago and asked 25-year-olds, how much are you in debt? And you asked them, today, they are 91% more in debt than they were 10 years ago. Now, some of that can be attributed to the fact that they can't find a job. But most of that is attributed to the fact that they have these massive student loans. This is the cancer stage of Reaganomics. You know, cancers start out as inflammation, and then it leads to, bad cells. You know, you see these kind of weird mutating cells, and then it becomes full-blown cancer. That's what's happened with Reaganomics in the 80s to today.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And therefore, it's time to completely repudiate Reaganomics and to have a jubilee. These kids never should have been in debt in the first place. We should have had free college education all along. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. David Vanderbeek, by the way, wants to go on. He's asked to be put on Obama's kill list. He's running on the Constitution Party platform. Whatever you call it, on the party, for governor of Nevada. He's the guy who said that the Sandy Hook massacre was done by the Obama administration in order to implement psychological evaluations of gun owners. He thinks that all terrorist attacks have been carried out by our government. Very strange. And Wisconsin is about to pass a law targeting early voting. Yeah, we got to do everything we can to stop people from voting. Can't have that nasty democracy thing going on, right? Meanwhile, the Koch brothers are outspending Democratic groups like 2-1. Huge margins. There's a fascinating piece about it over at Huffington Post today titled Democrats' Worst Nightmare Coming True. It's really not the Democrats' nightmare. It's democracy's nightmare. This is what the Supreme Court has given us, is an oligarchy, a form of government run or influenced by, substantially influenced or run by oligarchs. The Koch brothers are the most powerful of the oligarchs in America, politically powerful of the oligarchs in America. It was amazing. Anyhow, a lot on the table today, and a bunch of other things that I want to get to as we continue through the day. But Fred Fell's passing, I think, is worthy of note. Ray in McHenry, Illinois, listening to WCPT.
Hi, Tom.
Yeah, hi, Ray.
I taught health education, really sex education, as part of that for 33 years, and I used to routinely hit young boys who would be openly homophobic, and I always got the impression, which you were consistent with what you were talking about, that they were part of that queue in the LGBTQ, and it was their way of trying to build a wall or something to protect themselves against something that frightened them. And that's kind of a common psychological process, I think, because you see it with people who give up drugs or smoking and things like that. They do the same thing. They build this wall, and sometimes they can get pretty, you know, obnoxious in the way they do it. And people do that who are struggling in all kinds of ways in their life, and then they find religion, and then suddenly they become so orthodox and so dogmatic in their beliefs. It's a way of trying to protect themselves from something that scares the heck out of them, either something that could be or something that was once before.
Something within themselves. Yeah, I think that's the basis of a lot of forms of bigotry and hatred. They're all grounded in fear, and a lot of that fear is projected out onto the world, but it's actually experienced internally. I think you're right, Ray, and you taught for 30-some-odd years sex ed in public schools?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, that's a good basis for an observation. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Tony in Santa Barbara, California. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm just going to beg to differ a little bit with what you're saying in terms of a lot of people that are, first of all, I don't even like the term homophobic because a lot of people aren't afraid of you. They just, of a gay person, they just don't like them.
They're bigots.
And I think they're bigots, right. And basically my thing is this, you know, being a black woman that has been through quite a bit over my lifetime, sometimes you have to look at a point of a person's life from the other side. Without a self, a lot of the hatred that has existed for so long, people wouldn't even know about.
That's a good point.
That's why I try to turn things around and look at there was a purpose for his life to show the ugly side.
That's an excellent point. You know, if George Wallace hadn't made that speech, you know, segregation now, segregation forever, if Lester Maddox hadn't stood at the door of the university with an axe handle, we would not have America, you know, at least middle class white America would not have seen the horrible, ugly face of white racial hatred.
Right. And that's what King was trying to say. He's like, if we are nonviolent and we can show the world. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that, but, you know, to show the world the depth of that hatred. And then the next thing I would say about him, think about it like this. If you truly believe in the Bible that you read, and maybe you're interpreting it wrong, because that's what I say as a Christian, he interpreted it incorrectly. But think about it, the fervor, the drive he had, he was truly believing what he believed.
Yeah.
Now, whether we agree or not, or whatever, to me, conservatism. You know, the fact that they're calling themselves Christian, and they're the least Christian people that I know. But the bottom line is that's the problem with a lot of religious dogma. You know, if he truly believed this in his heart, really, and he really was fighting for it, you have to look at it from that point of view, too. It's incorrect. I think he misapplied everything. But you got to look at it. Some people are so-called homophobic because they truly, truly, truly are trying to believe and live what they think is right.
But see, respectfully, Tony, I think that's secondary. I think the primary thing is some sort of internal, deep-seated fear that becomes hatred. You know, if Fred Phelps knew the Bible well enough, he graduated from Bob Jones University, he had to encounter that spot in the New Testament, I think it's in Matthew, where the guy comes, in fact, I think it was one of his disciples said to him, what is the most important of the Ten Commandments? And Jesus said, unambiguously, he said, love your Father in heaven, love God with all your heart and all your soul, and along with that, love your brother as if he was you. I'm paraphrasing badly, I'm sure, but there was never any doubt that love others was the first among all the commandments, and how hating people could be elevated above that just flies in the face of any kind of biblical scholarship in my mind.
But let's face it, Tom, the Klan was a Christian organization.
Oh, I know. Slavery was justified by the Bible. I mean, you know, because Paul said, treat your slaves well.
Right. And they're taking the letter and the semantics of the words to a point that's beyond. Let's face it, a lot of the Old Testament is old Jewish law. If you're a Christian, you should believe in the New Testament when Jesus said, you know, you're never going to do the law. So forget that. That's what I came here for.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that was another thing that Jesus said. You know, he didn't. Well, actually, he said, "I didn't come to change the law or destroy the law. I came to fulfill it." But I don't want to turn my show into a theology program. But Tony, thank you. I think you make an excellent point. And you know, homophobia. Yeah, it is not strong enough. You don't say that people who are, you know, in the Klan are blackophobic. You say they're bigots. Jenny in American Falls in Idaho. Hey, Jenny, what's up?
Hi, thank you, Tom. I just want to tell you that you give me hope.
Well, thank you.
And I just want to thank you for that.
I have a lot of hope, Jenny. I have a lot of optimism. So, anyway.
Thank you. I want to talk about the issue of choice, and I really, really wish that somebody could send this study to Africa to that leader over there. But a few weeks ago, there was a report, I'm not positive, but I think it was on Democracy Now!, but it's about atrazine. Anybody who wants to can Google this up, but me, I don't have internet, but atrazine is being given to us in the form of our corn. It's a It's a herbicide that's produced by Syngenta in Southern California, and it was reported in an International Journal of Toxicology by a UC Berkeley professor who was also hired to research this, and he found and published in this journal that atrazine contains an estrogen which has been related by this research to cause underdevelopment of male genitals and development of female genitals in fish, frogs, birds, and humans.
Yeah, that's that research has been out for 20, 30 years. That's but the implications of that are pretty scary. And in fact, there's also a lot of concern that it might be that and all the other. It's not actually an estrogen, it's an estrogen mimicker. And that these chemicals that mimic estrogen in the body or promote estrogen in the body might even be associated with some of the estrogen-sensitive cancers.
Right. And the thing about it is they're finding that these the subjects affected by this have homosexual behaviors. Of course, with too much female hormone and not enough male hormone, the males turn to other males.
Yeah. Well, but that said, homosexuality has been around as long as humans have been around, and we find it in other species. So I don't think that we can lay homosexuality at the feet of atrazine. I think that there's a good reason to be concerned about atrazine. But Jenny, thank you for the call. Ed in Lyons, Illinois. I've got a minute to the break, Ed. You got a quick one?
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say, to this day, I think the person who put it best was Kris Kristofferson in the lyrics to the song Jesus Was a Capricorn. That song just nails it. You know, most people are afraid of anything they don't understand.
Yeah, everybody needs somebody to look down on. If you're in need of someone, help yourself to me. Was that the refrain?
Yeah, I'm serious. I tell people all the time, you got to listen to that song. It's simple, and it really nails it.
Yeah.
And while you're listening to that song, revisit Chris Mooney's book, The Republican Brain.
Yeah.
That was an excellent book on why some people are just wired to fear.
Yeah. Yeah, John Dean's Conservatives Without a Conscience, another great book that gets into that kind of stuff.
And unfortunately, the Republican Party just knows how to play that fear.
Oh, they sure do. And they turn into policy. Ed, thanks a lot for the call. One of the things that mystified me the other day, I was watching a television report on the Ugandan anti-gay laws, and why didn't they mention the fact that there's a couple of Republican senators who've made, one of them made over 100 trips to Uganda? And they don't have some responsibility for this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, the family is just up to their eyeballs in this stuff, this right-wing Christian Republican cult here in Washington, D.C. Cat alarm clocks are the best alarm clocks, really? Welcome back. Yeah, when your cat gets up, it wakes you up. Liz in West Hollywood, California, watching Free Speech TV on the website there at freespeech.org. Hey, Liz, what's on your mind today?
Hi. When I was in college back in the 60s, we had to take this contemporary civilization class, and in walks a man with a yarmulke on and gets in front of the class, and he's our professor. And he was a Jewish scholar, and at some point during the semester, we got on the topic of homosexuality, and he said the only reason the Jews outlawed it was because the race was becoming extinct. And if you look at the really, really Orthodox, they procreate like crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, they have 8, 10, 12 children.
Yeah.
And that's what it was about. It was because the race was becoming extinct. It was not because of any kind of morality issue. It was just a survival of the species. So.
Well, there may be something to that. I mean, there was a time, and Dan Quinn does a great job of chronicling this era in his books, Ishmael and My Ishmael. There was a time in human history when, at the dawn of the agricultural revolution, when we set ourselves up in tribes and started nailing down land rather than being hunter-gatherers who ranged over large areas. We settled down and said, this is our space. And the tribe that had the largest population had the largest army, and the largest army typically wiped out the smaller armies. And much of several books in the Bible, particularly the book of Joshua, are all about those wars and all about, you know, being killing off or being killed by other tribes. And so I think that you can, you know, when you look back in history and you see that, for example, the oppression of women, not just the disapproval of homosexuality, but the oppression of women is actually sanctioned in the Bible and in the religious texts of many groups, many different religions and many different cultures. And what we have to remember is that those are the cultures that outnumbered the ones that didn't survive. And you can make a strong argument that at a particular time in the history of the human race, the tribe that had the largest population, and of course oppressing women causes them to have more babies, and empowering women allows them to have fewer babies, that the tribes that survived, you know, that there was a sociological adaptation there. And if we were to look at it through the lens of sociology and anthropology and say, oh yeah, okay, that's why that developed back during the Bronze Age. But does that make any sense today when we've got 7 billion people on the planet? Then you get it.
No,
it makes no sense at all anymore, right? To either oppress women or to oppress gays.
And that was my second point. I never thought about it that way as far as war, but it was a matter of survival too. I mean, women didn't have birth control, and if you had 18, 20 children, you were lucky. This goes back even to the 1900s.
Yes.
They were lucky if three of them lasted. So it was a matter of survival to have a lot of children.
Yeah, there you go. Liz, thank you for the call. It's time in this world of 7+ billion people for us to be reevaluating a lot of our social norms. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 10 minutes before the hour. And Bernie Sanders is not going to be with us tomorrow because he's traveling to South America, of all places. And that's going to be an interesting, I hope he has some interesting stories to bring back. But I had this interesting conversation yesterday with Tim Carpenter. There's a bunch of us, you can sign the petition over at pdamerica.org, who are petitioning Bernie to run in the Democratic primary in 2016 and to get in there early so that whoever does come in who may have bigger funding and more party support and will probably more likely be the candidate will have to take more progressive positions in order to be a serious player. And I think history shows that's how, I mean, this is certainly how the Republican Party moved so far to the right. But Marcia disagrees. Marcia in Angier, North Carolina. Hey, Marcia, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Yeah, I disagree. Yesterday, I was very disheartened. First of all, I'm a Green Party member, and we had the idea of inviting Senator Sanders to run as a Green Party person, and we made a petition like in the beginning of January, you can find that on Facebook, in the Facebook Bernie Sanders Go Green. But it feels like a great idea has been stolen from us again. I wanted to say that a couple of things. Like, okay, number one, right this second, Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat. And I think that you know, not that he's like...
But he caucuses with the Democrats.
Of course he does.
Officially.
What other choice does he have? There's not like a lot of other progressive parties. But I think...
he could refuse to caucus with the Democrats.
But the point is, he has the ability to run, to be a Democrat, to be a Republican, he did not want to be a Democrat for a reason, and that reason is about the corporate influence over the Democratic Party. You got people like Max Baucus and all these other people. Like, I'm in North Carolina.
Well, Bernie's been on this show every Friday for 9 years now, and I've never heard him say that. What I have heard him say is that he chose not to be a member of the Democratic Party because he wants to be himself. He's always been, I mean, he was a Democratic Socialist for a while when he ran for mayor of Burlington, but he's always been an independent. He was the longest serving independent in the history of the House of Representatives. And he likes being an independent. He has never phrased it in that negative context that you're saying.
The reason he likes being an independent is what he believes in, what he wants to put forward.
Right.
And,
in an affirmative sense.
People power and these kinds of things. People leave the Democratic Party because they're trying to go towards those things. And it reminds me of like when the unions first started. I'm sure people were like they were afraid to leave because they didn't want to join a union. They didn't want to lose their jobs. But you know, I don't see how you can fight for constitutional amendments, fight for health care for all, and these things when you're involved with people who are still obligated to do what corporations want because they take that money. If you want more people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, you have to. You can find them in the Green Party.
But Elizabeth Warren is a Democrat.
That way.
No, I'm a big fan of the Green Party. I love the Green Party. I voted for Ralph Nader in 2000.
Well, why don't you join, Tom? Join. You know,
because the Democratic Party has the power, and if enough of us infiltrate the Democratic Party, we can make it a more progressive organization.
We cannot. People have
the Green Party seriously, Marcia.
Since form his own party, everybody is trying to do something. The Occupy movement. Everybody has tried to change the Democratic Party. It doesn't happen.
No,
like
there
that.
Has not been a serious. The Occupy movement never tried to change the Democratic Party. They were very clearly outside the Democratic Party, and in fact, they're going to be rolling out their own political party next month, and it's going to be the Occupy Party or some variation on that. And it's going
to. Why not? Why aren't they trying to pull the Democrats to the left? Is my point.
Well, I think they should be. I think the Concord coalition strategy that worked to allow the Tea Party to take over the Republican Party should be done by all the rest of us. You can be a Green and a Democrat. Should be done for the Democratic Party, except in those states where you have to declare one or the other for the purposes of a primary. But you can show up at both parties. You can be involved in both parties. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, since the second presidency, you know, since the John Adams presidency, we've had a two-party system because we have first-past-the-post, winner-take-all elections. And until we get instant runoff voting or we have a serious change and go to proportional,
proportional voting where everybody is represented based on how many.
Yeah, I'm forgetting the name of it.
Not instant runoff. We found out that that's a big mistake, too. That's just.
Well, that's how you got a Green as mayor of San Francisco.
Yeah, but, I mean, there's some YouTubes on it that actually show you the math. It's just like eventually you'd back down to two parties again.
Proportional representation is what it's called.
You want corporations out of your politics, you can have it right this minute by not contributing to parties that continue to allow those corporations in their party. You got a guy, Will Stewart, right now trying to run against Kay Hagan. Nobody knows this guy. It's good. Did Kay Hagan go to the Up for Climate thing? No. But if you want to try to put somebody in who's more progressive, this is going to take like eons of people to support him. Because he doesn't take money from corporations.
Well, and this is where, you know, in New York State, they have fusion voting. You can be both on the Green Party ticket and the Democratic Party ticket. And that, I think, is a really good thing, too. That's an alternative. That's halfway to proportional representation, or IRP. But, Marcia, I would like to see Bernie run as a Democrat, obviously. But thank you for your call, and thank you for your perspective. I respect it. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters: Identity Guard, Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And let's check in with Mike Papantonio, the attorney, the host of the Ring of Fire Radio. He's an author as well. RingofFireRadio.com is the website. Hey, Pap, welcome back.
Tom, how are you?
Just great. You know, we were having a conversation this morning when we were putting this show together and the TV show and kicking around the idea of, is there some way, without really blowing up the First Amendment, to hold these climate change deniers, the Rex Tillerson, ExxonMobil, Koch brothers, the guys who are funding the front men, the phony scientists, to hold them responsible for the literally the death and destruction that they are causing and that they will cause in much greater proportion around the world? And the consensus that we came to was we should ask somebody who really knows this stuff. Is this analogous, for example, to the tobacco industry saying, well, tobacco won't cause cancer, and then you're one of the people who took them on, so we decided to ask you.
There's not a lot of analogy there, Tom. I think the best way to explain this is if you start with Michael Mann. Michael Mann was, of course, the climate scientist who came up with the notion of the hockey stick. He showed what mankind was doing to the environment. He said it was directly related to mankind's use of fossil fuel, said it's killing our planet, showed everybody how that was happening. And then scientist after scientist started lining up behind Michael Mann, and the industry did exactly what I see almost every day the industry doing, and that is to attack the scientists that have anything to say about the way they're conducting business. So that's what they do with Michael Mann. Now, Michael Mann brought a lawsuit in the United States that was a slander defamation lawsuit, tried to articulate damages about how bad this is hurting. And he actually made it past some of the first test, which is a motion to dismiss. And at this point, I think he's even made it past summary judgment. But if I were advising Michael Mann, I would have told him, probably you should bring this case in the UK. You should bring it in England, because they have different standards in England. For example, in England, when you assert the kind of story that Michael Mann has here, where he's received death threats, his job has suffered, his money, he's suffered economic losses because of it, his family has suffered, they've made just completely made up stories about him just out of the thin blue, just out of the air. And so a case like that in the UK has a better chance at surviving than it does in the United States. And there's a real easy, there's a simple reason. The United States has something, what they call the New York Times malice rule. And you have to say that a person that rises to a public figure, that they have to show pretty ugly conduct in order to make an argument that they have been defamed, because the First Amendment protects the person who makes the claim, no matter how outrageous it is. New York Times malice rule is pretty tough to overcome. In the UK, not the case. As a matter of fact, it's very interesting in the UK. In the UK, the burden is on the defendant, the person who has made these statements, to prove that the statements cause no harm or that the statements were true. Now, it's a shift of burden, and the chances of success in the UK is much better. When you're talking about something as big as global climate change, it doesn't make any difference what forum you go to. You simply go to the best forum. All you're really trying to do, you're trying to make the lives miserable for the people who fund this trash. You're trying to engage in discovery. Here's what's important. What we find anytime we're involved in a lawsuit, and you can get me in front of a CEO, and I have the right to ask questions, the company suffers really badly. Because I ask questions that cause them harm. Those questions are then made public. We're involved right now with half a dozen cases like that where the company is more concerned about the public image than they are protecting that CEO. So what you do is you go to the best forum, and I would say the best forum is the UK because of a whole collection of reasons.
Hmm. That's very interesting. Back, if I could just dial this back to tobacco and climate change. We've got, you had, you know, RJR and friends saying to us, go ahead and, you know, via Ronald Reagan, you know, if you got a sore throat, smoke Pall Mells. It's not going to harm you, denying harm. And we now have, in the climate change realm, you've got big oil. I mean, you know, ExxonMobil has actually funded some of these groups overtly, and presumably the Koch brothers as well, who are saying, no, carbon dioxide is really not causing problems. And meanwhile, people literally, I mean, Sandy killed people. You know, there are events that are so, they fall out, so outside the normal distribution of random events that they almost certainly are caused by climate change. Is it not possible to go after them the same way, you know, the fossil fuel industry, the carbon dioxide producing industry, the same way that we went after the tobacco industry?
Yeah, well, one fundamental in the law, the type of thing you're talking about, is there, it's a very important fundamental. It's called the Paulsgraf case. The Paulsgraf case said that the person bringing the case has to show that the party they're bringing it for, that the connection between the conduct of the defendant and the injury of the plaintiff is so direct that the causal relationship, we can conclude there's a causal relationship. Tobacco, for example, what we did in the tobacco cases, we got attorney generals from each state that had a direct loss because of the Medicaid money that they were having to pay out for people who were dying from COPD or cancer. Now, this isn't quite the situation because you have so many complicating factors. The best argument would be that if you had a population that was affected with something, there's many ways to get to it, but one way is you have to show that a population is affected directly. Here's 10 people or here's 100 people, and this climate change has affected those people directly in a direct type of injury.
People who live on the Jersey Shore?
Well, there is a connection probably, but again, Tom, it is just, it's a very difficult road to go unless you're able to show real clear causation.
Right.
In the Jersey Shore case, you would have to say, but for the conduct of the defendant, okay, which might be the people who financed the global climate denier, might have been people actually directly involved in creating phonied up literature that's coming from the universities. You'd have to say, but for their conduct, this would not have occurred.
So we just have to wait for this extreme weather to get so extreme that
I don't take that route. I think you do what Michael Mann is doing. Listen, the thing that you do is you make climate deniers, you put them in a posture, Tom, to where it's not worth it for them to be taken to court in a place like the UK and to be made into a fraud. Because what you do is you dry up their money. Ultimately, people don't hire them anymore.
Right.
They're known as fraud. They're known as climate denier frauds who are paid for by the industry. That's what you have to do time and time again. I've always thought the best way at this is an organization that puts together a big bunch of money and simply goes after these people one at a time, makes their lives so miserable that, by God, they don't want to sign off on phonied up biostitute literature that's coming out of the universities right now.
A lot of these guys who are denying climate change, I mean, you know, Singer, I mean, they used to be tobacco guys.
Of course, yeah. Look, you actually have people that will work for, you know, you see them switching sides all the time. You see them, sometimes they just stay with industry. They are what they call, what I call biostitutes. And that is, they will prostitute their degree. They'll prostitute their position at a university, position with an organization, maybe a governmental agency. They will prostitute it for the right amount of money all the time. Always can count on that.
Fascinating. Mike Papantonio, America's lawyer, giving us very good legal advice here. Well, maybe you shouldn't call it that, right? I don't know. Pap, great having you on. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
And check out Pap's website, ringoffireradio.com, and, of course, listen for ringoffire.com, and be sure to listen to his radio program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Hey, Pap, is that Ring of Fire or ringoffireradio.com?
It's ringoffireradio.com.
Radio. Yeah. Thank you very much. I got a typewriter issue. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mike Papantonio is still on the line with us. Hey, Pap.
Tom.
So in addition to Ring of Fire Radio, you also do Ring of Fire TV right here on Free Speech TV every weekend, every Sunday at noon. And then it plays throughout the week at different times throughout the week. And what do you have coming up this week?
Well, we're going to talk. Well, Howard Nations is going to be talking about the problems of wealth concentration at the 1%. People hear it. We hear it all the time. You know, the 1%, the 99%. But what we're going to do is talk. We're going to kind of diagram in words what it really means to the American public, all the way from middle class to working poor. We're going to talk about certain sects of American public that are allowed basic. They're allowed basic human rights according to what the Republican Party wants them to have. Sam Cedar's going to be talking about Republican racism. He's a very interesting story that's developed this week developed last week, and it's not a single story, but it's the story of congressmen and senators who have started adopting very direct words about race. And what I mean by that is it's almost as if the Republican Party has figured out, Tom, that they've lost the war of demographics. So what they're moving into is something that I would call a South African kind of mentality. That is, the whites in South Africa were outnumbered one to a gazillion, but they said, we're going to stay here by making the few whites that are here so militant and so crazy that they will hold our ground. If you listen to the talk of the Republicans, whether it's coming from Paul Ryan, whether it's coming from, it's almost every week, a senator, a representative from the Republican Party, somebody in leadership is almost said, look, you know what? We're not even going to dress this up anymore. We're not going to talk in dog whistle terms. When you have Paul Ryan coming out saying the things that he's saying, or Rand Paul coming out and saying that the things that he's saying about working poor African American types, they've decided that they've lost the demographics race. Therefore, they're going to say, we only have this population to count on, the white, stale, male, and pale. So what we're going to do is we're going to empower them, we're going to anger them, and we're going to get them ready for the next 25 years where we're going to lose the demographics race.
Yeah. Yeah. It's certainly what they're up to. And Wisconsin, I mean, today or tomorrow, the governor's going to be signing legislation to do away with early voting. So it's not just anger the base, but it's also lock out everybody else.
Yeah. Well, they're desperate times for the GOP, but what I find most interesting, when you saw the senator, last week that I can't think of his name right off the top, but the senator that said, you know what, it's going to be just fine for a restaurant owner to tell an African American that we won't serve you because you're African American.
Well, Rand Paul has said that. He said he wouldn't vote for the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights
Act.
That's right.
And this man reduced it to just very clear. He said a restaurant owner, a business owner should be able to tell anybody they want, African American, whether they're, regardless of what their gender preference is, you know, you can't eat here, you're different. Now, that idiot, of course, has to ignore the Commerce Clause, has to ignore the 14th Amendment, has to ignore damn near everything to get there.
Yeah, there you go. Mike Papantonio, you can see the show Ring of Fire TV right here on Free Speech TV, Sunday at noon, and replayed throughout the week. You can see where and how over ringoffireradio.com and freespeech.org. Thanks, Pap.
Thank you, Tom.
It is always great to see you.
Thank you.
We'll be back. Okay, welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yesterday, we played this clip yesterday, but I want to play it again today because of the context. either yesterday or today, depending on which time zone you're looking at, George W. Bush started bombing Iraq without the UN's permission, over the objection of many countries around the world. He began bombing Iraq and killing Iraqi civilians, absolutely innocent people, and started a war that to this day, I mean, right now, as we speak, violence in Iraq is continuing. Car bombings, suicide bombings, muggings, murders, revenge killings, rape is at an all-time high. It's basically turned into a lawless country. And to the extent that there is a government, the government has been taken over by Shias, who are favorable to Iran. The first business to really formally open business in Iraq was the Bank of Tehran in downtown Baghdad. And so it's basically, it's an oil state, a petro state, just exactly what Dick Cheney and George W. Bush envisioned. In fact, in the spring of 2001, long before 9/11, Dick Cheney had been given two jobs as vice president. One was to run the counterterrorism task force, which didn't even bother to meet until September of 2001. And the second was to run the energy task force, which was meeting in March and February, March, April, May, and June of 2001 in secret. Nobody but oil executives and fossil fuel executives were invited. The public was not invited. Legislators were not invited. Environmentalists were not invited. And they were literally, and Larry Klayman with Judicial Watch, you know, dug this stuff out and published it, with the Freedom of Information Act, literally in March and April of 2001, 6 months before 9/11, Dick Cheney was carving up the oil fields of Iraq, including the oil fields that had not yet been drilled, and deciding which countries and which companies they were going to sell that oil to. And, this was the beginning and end. Paul O'Neill. It was Paul O'Neill, wasn't it? That was ranting about yesterday. He was in the cabinet. He was the Secretary of the Treasury in the Bush administration. He was fired by George Bush in his second year on the job, and he published a book in which he said the very first cabinet meeting he went to, the very first cabinet meeting, in January of 2001, a week after the president was sworn in, the first thing they put on the table was, how do we invade Iraq and take down Saddam Hussein? Even though he represented no threat to the United States, he had nothing to do with Al Qaeda. At that time, this was long before 9/11. How do we take this guy out and get his oil? And Paul O'Neill wrote it's in his book. So today is the anniversary of that. What would it be? The 11th anniversary, I guess. It's 2014. That was 2003. March. What is today? The 20th? Yeah, March 19th and 20th, the 13th anniversary, or the 11th anniversary, the invasion of Iraq, the illegal invasion of Iraq, based on lies by the United States. And here's what George Galloway, member of the British Parliament at the time, representing a part of Scotland, as I recall, not only said on this program, he came on our program a number of times, but here's what he said, speaking before the United States House of Representatives, the United States Congress, Senate.
And I told the world that your case for the war was a pack of lies. I told the world that Iraq, contrary to your claims, did not have weapons of mass destruction. I told the world, contrary to your claims, that Iraq had no connection to Al-Qaeda. I told the world, contrary to your claims, that Iraq had no connection to the atrocity on 9/11/2001. I told the world, contrary to your claims, that the Iraqi people would resist a British and American invasion of their country, and that the fall of Baghdad would not be the beginning of the end, but merely the end of the beginning. Senator, in everything I said about Iraq, I turned out to be right, and you turned out to be wrong. And 100,000 people have paid with their lives, 1,600 of them American soldiers, sent to their deaths, on a pack of lies. 15,000 of them wounded, many of them disabled forever on a pack of lies. If the world had listened to Kofi Annan, whose dismissal you demanded, if the world had listened to President Chirac, who you want to paint as some kind of corrupt traitor, if the world had listened to me and the anti-war movement in Britain, we would not be in the disaster that we are in today.
And so, you know, that said, it raises a question. In the first hour, we asked, you know, what, how should we react to the passage today of Fred Phelps? And we had Fred's son, Nate, on talking about that. In this hour, I'd like to ask, how should we react to the 11th anniversary of George Bush declaring an illegal war? An illegal war, a pair of illegal wars, really. I believe Afghanistan was an illegal war, too, that have led to the death of almost 6,000, I believe, U.S. soldiers, and more than that if you include contractors, and displaced at least 5 million Iraqis and Afghans, and killed hundreds of thousands of them. And in that context, I was very heartened to see the President of the United States, President Barack Obama, today say, no, we're not going to use any kind of military option with regard to Crimea and Ukraine. It's like the last thing the United States needs is another war in a place where we have no business and no interest. And we've said no to war in Syria. We've said no to war in Iraq. I think these are good things. I know the neocons are freaking out.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
But what kind of response to the illegal invasion of Iraq 11 years ago today could we be doing that might highlight our penance to the world? The bad and the very, very bellipotently ugly, brought to you by the organic wine company, ecowine.com. The good, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. The PTO has rejected an application to copyright the name Washington Redskin Potatoes because, surprise, surprise, the name is offensive to American Indians. In a decision issued on March 17th, the Copyright and Patent Office said, the registration of the name Washington Redskin Potatoes is refused because the applied for mark includes matter which may disparage or bring into contempt or disrepute persons, institutions, beliefs, or national symbols. The PTO should be commended for pointing out what should be obvious to everyone, that the word redskin is a racial slur that doesn't belong anywhere in our culture. Let's hope the NFL is paying attention. The bad, Bill Hemmer. Fox so-called news anchor really wants to find missing Malaysian Flight 370, but he's worried it might take a long time to find it. As long a time, in fact, as it took to find Noah's Ark. Noah's Ark? Seriously, take a look.
So it took us, what, 100 years to find the Titanic? It took us 2,000 years to find Noah's Ark?
Yeah.
Do we ever find Flight 370?
Oh, I think we find Flight 370 much sooner than those two things, thank God.
And people wonder why I call it Fox so-called news. And the very, very ugly Rush Limbaugh. During his radio show yesterday, the conservative pundit went off on the idea of creating a National Women's History Museum. He said it was a ridiculous idea and tried to prove his point by making a terrible joke. Check it out.
We already have, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know how many museums for women all over the country called malls. I told you we had to get lighter.
Right. Satire or not, that kind of sexism is just very, very ugly.
That's incredibly ugly.
Okay. In Encino, New Mexico, John has a suggestion for what we should do for this 11th anniversary of the illegal invasion of Iraq. What is it, John?
Hi, I'm honored to speak with you, Tom. I wish we could get Vincent Bugosi, I hope he's still alive, to talk about the prosecution of George Bush Dick Cheney for murder, for all 100,000 Iraqis and all those thousands of Americans. And
right. Vince has a standing invitation to this program. The last time we directly contacted him was 3 or 4 months ago, and we were told that he is not in good health right now. So apparently.
Really? You've already been trying.
Oh, well, yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. Vince Bugliosi has been on this program many, many times over the years. And when his book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, first came out, I probably had him on the program a dozen times over the course of a year or two. I thought it was a seminal book. It was because it's basically a prosecutor's brief for prosecutors in at the state or county level, at the city or county level, where any jurisdiction where somebody has died in Iraq, and it could be done. It absolutely could be done. And I'm frankly astounded that no prosecutors ever tried it.
You know, a governor in a state had their grandkids murdered over there. Seemed like he would because any state could prosecute, right?
Yeah, yeah. Murder is against the law as a state law in every state in the union. And Vince Bugliosi, in his book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, builds a brilliant. I mean, he himself was a prosecutor. He prosecuted Charles Manson. He wrote a book about it called Helter Skelter, and Manson's still in prison. And he writes this brilliant prosecutor's brief. I thought it was really, really marvelous. John, thanks a lot for the call. Great suggestion. Tim in Hendersonville, North Carolina. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hey, I love your program, by the way. I think you're the brightest person in history, at least on the airways.
Yeah.
Listen.
Thank you.
I want to know exactly what, when George Bush started this, I remember him making comments that this was not going to cost America one dime.
Right.
What is to all of the revenue that from all of the oil that Iraq's been producing, has produced? And, when gas prices shot up to $3-4 a gallon, I think you could make the case that single-handedly that was the result not only for the housing bubble, but for the demise of the economy as we knew it.
Yeah. Gas prices went up in large part because they're being manipulated by Wall Street traders. And you can thank Phil Graham and his wife, Wendy, and Ken Lay, who his wife worked for that, the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. But the where did the money go? Has a fairly straightforward answer. The first country to officially negotiate drilling rights in Iraq and start buying Iraqi oil and thus making a profit on it was China. So I think CNOOC is the name of the company, but the big Chinese oil company is making a lot of money in Iraq. I believe that several American oil companies are currently exporting oil from Iraq and drilling for oil in Iraq. There's a Dutch Shell is there. British Petroleum is there, I believe. And then there's, as Dick Cheney originally envisioned, I mean, if you look at that document that was published by Larry Klayman's Judicial Watch, you could probably fairly easily find it with DuckDuckGo or Google or one of the search engines by typing in Dick Cheney Judicial Watch Iraq documents or something like that. And you can actually see the map of Iraq, and then there's a table that's attached to it, and it's got marked out each one of the oil fields, and they're labeled. They're named, and they also have a numerical, A-17, A-18, A-19, things like that. And then there's a table next to it, a spreadsheet, that says, okay, A-17, this could probably go to Brazil, and their oil company is XYZ, or the A-18, this could probably go to Holland, and their oil company is Royal Dutch Shell. And they've got it. I mean, they basically were dividing up the oil among all the countries of the world, presumably the countries that would participate in a coalition to help take down Saddam. And this was being planned in February, March, and April of 2001, 6 months before 9/11. So when 9/11 happened, they were ready. And that's where the money's going. It's going to oil companies all over the world. It's certainly not coming to us. We just, we just paid for the soldiers, and we continue to pay for the soldiers. And our soldiers who were there continue to pay the cost of that war in terms of disabilities and PTSD and just the god-awful horror of what they saw and everything else. Tim, thanks for the call. Great question. Michael, in Pahokee, Florida, you want to get back to the death today of Fred Phelps.
Well, I was listening to your program earlier, and it was very interesting, but I wanted to just mention that when you come across a person who's a homophobe, in my my experience, they're just a repressed homosexual. That's all it is.
I think in some cases that's the case. I think more frequently they are bisexual. They're people who are capable of having and enjoying sexual relationships with both genders, and they're freaked out about the fact that they can imagine having pleasant sex with somebody of the same sex.
People that are heterosexual, they're simply not interested.
That's right.
It doesn't bother them. They're secure in their feelings. They're secure in their relationships, and they're simply not interested.
That's
it's
right.
The repressed homosexuals who really are.
See, I think you're drawing that parallel that many of us did for many, many years, which doesn't include bisexuals, that people are either straight or they're gay. And there is a middle ground, and I've been sensitized to this by having a number of these folks call into this program and say, I'm one of them. I can enjoy sex with a man. I can enjoy sex with a woman. To me, it's the same thing. And I think that they're a very small subset of the population, far smaller than the gay population. And I know that there are gay, you know, fairly prominent gay spokesmen. I think it was Dan Savage was one of them, who have come out and said that people who claim that they're bisexual are actually just gay people who are in denial. But I don't think that that's the case. I think that there actually are bisexual people. And those are the folks who can say with an absolute straight face from the depth of their own personal experience that being gay or behaving in a way that is gay, in other words, acting out sexually with the same sex, is a choice. Because for them, it is a choice. They can choose to have sex with a man or with a woman. It doesn't matter.
Well, the bisexual argument is also part of the coming out process. First you say you're bi, and then you finally admit that you're gay.
Well, for some, you know, that's sort of how Elton John did it, and, you know, it's how some fairly high-profile, you know, gay people have done it. But I don't – that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the social – thing. I'm talking about an actual psychology, biology, whatever. You know, I think you're still
I don't have experience with those people, but I do have experience with repressed homosexuals.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and it may be that there are some people who are just plain old flat out gay, and that what was it? Ted Hagee was his name, or whoever that pastor was. Haggard. Yeah. Who, you know, who got busted for having sex with a male prostitute and doing drugs with him and all that kind of stuff. And he was a big, you know, preacher. May well be that, you know, he was actually just, you know, totally gay and just really gritting his teeth when he was, you know, making babies with his wife. I don't know. I'm reluctant to judge other people. And that's the thing that I think, that, you know, the message that we all need to take out of this is that we should all be reluctant to judge other people. Michael, thank you for the call. And for, you know, but yeah, I you know, it surprises me. And like I said to Nate Phelps, to Fred Phelps' son at the beginning of the first hour of this program, you know, I've had conversations with some of these people who are high profile anti-gay folks. And it surprises me how many of them seem gay to me.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Or trigger my gaydar. I don't know how to say it beyond that. It's just, you know, but I do think that it probably has more to do with bisexuality. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Vivian in Albuquerque, New Mexico, watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, Vivian, what's up?
Oh, yes. I have a question. Earlier when you talked about Mr. Phelps passing, you mentioned him going into the light, his going into the light, and I know you've mentioned that over the years with other people's passing. What do you mean by that? And can you recommend a couple of books about what happens after death that have inspired you?
Well, that's a good question. It's been at least 30 years since I read any books on what happens after death, and so I don't have any titles right off the top of my head, although There is a River by Tom Segrew, which is the story of Edgar Cayce, is a fascinating and very accessible book. The experience of the light is just a fairly common experience that has been described by people. That light is one of the highest forms of energy that our sensory system can perceive, and so my opinion is that when we die, And also there might be a biological basis for this. The occipital region of the brain that processes vision is the largest and most complex and well developed and massive part of our entire brain. And that's why, for example, the memory tricks that they teach you, like if you want to remember somebody's name and you look at their face and their name is Pat, and you think of patting their cheeks or something. If you can think of some kind of a picture, you can remember things longer than if you say the words in your brain, in your head. And the reason for that is that the Broca's region, the left parietal part of the brain, over near the ears, that stores auditory memory is fairly small compared to this giant horsepower, huge visual processing in the back of the brain, the occipital region. And so it makes sense to me that that would be firing last, that would be the thing that would, that we'd go out by as an experience. But I also think that everything in the universe is made out of energy, that all matter is reducible to, or is dissolvable, is divisible into energy, and that the only sensory mechanism that we have for energy, our taste buds and our smell are actually detecting particles. Our ears are detecting energy, our eardrums, but it's a very low frequency energy, auditory energy. Our nerves are detecting, electrical impulses caused by physical touch, but our eyes are detecting part of the electromagnetic spectrum that's really, really high up in frequency. That we see as visible light. And I think that's about as close as we can perceive to the energy that is everything in the universe, that started out as a singularity in the Big Bang and now is everything. And so that's the passage, I believe, that we... Am I making any sense here?
Yes, I just wanted to know if there was life after life.
Oh, I don't know, but I'm absolutely convinced that our consciousness becomes part of the consciousness of everything in the universe when we die. And that, frankly, it always is. And that we're separated from access to it by our egos, by our personality. Whether reincarnation is real or not, I don't know. I've seen some really startling evidence of it, including in my own family. But I can't assert those things as absolute fact. Vivian, thank you for the call. There Is a River by Tom Segura. Victoria doesn't work on Thursday. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Very interesting. Doug in San Diego. Hey, Doug, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Just listening to your latest caller, she might like the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Yeah, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, we were talking about what happens when you die going into the light. The Tibetan Book of the Dead is it walks you through the seven bardos, through the layers that you go through as you shed personality, all the way to the final bardo, oneness with all things and total loss of ego, and then you can also come back from that. In fact, it was the basis of the LSD training that Timothy Leary came up with back in the 1960s when he sent his 12 disciples out.
Yeah, I just finished Flashbacks. I've had my bookshelf for about 20 years.
Yeah, yeah. I went through that. I went through that when I was 16 or 17 years old, as it was still legal at the time. Anyhow, back to you, Doug. You wanted to talk about the cabinet member?
I called to ask you the name of Bush's cabinet member that was discussing...
it was Paul O'Neill, I'm pretty sure.
The invasion of Iraq in January of 2011.
Right.
I want to get his book.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was Paul O'Neill, and Shane is quickly Googling it right now. Can you find the title of Paul O'Neill's book, Shane? Yeah, he's going to track this down while we're talking.
Great.
But the core of his book is not... It's the title of the book is The Price of Loyalty. And he was fired by George W. Bush. Yeah, The Price of Loyalty by Paul O'Neill. And he was, yes, no, maybe, no, hang on just a second. Shane says that's not the title of the book. It was the title of an article about the book. He's going to track it down. But anyhow, it should be, go to Amazon.com and plug in Paul O'Neill.
Well, I won't go to Amazon. Yeah. I'll go to my local bookstore and pay.
No, no, I was saying Shane could do that right now and get it for me online and I can give it to you.
Yeah, yeah.
But maybe not. Let me do a little during the next break, the top of the hour. I'll do a little bit of internet search and get his name, because I'm doing this from memory and my memory is not always 100% on, particularly when it comes to names.
That sounds like something everybody should read.
Well, at the time, it created a minor sensation. And, you know, the whole book isn't about this. This was just a few sentences in the book. And it was about how mystified he was. In fact, the essence of what he wrote was he couldn't figure out why, you know, the very first thing, the very first cabinet meeting that they wanted to discuss was invading Iraq, when he thought that the country had really serious problems. We were sliding into a recession. The dot-com bubble had burst. You know, we had to come up with a budget. We had to, as a Secretary of the Treasury, he was concerned about those things. And he's like, you know, why are we planning a war with Iraq? I don't get it. And I think he was prescient. So, Doug, I'll have the for sure information for you within the next 10 minutes, okay?
Okay, well, I'll hang up and keep listening.
Okay, thanks a lot.
It was a pleasure and just nice to talk to you, man. I'm kind
of thank you.
I've been listening to you for years. Anyway,
thank you, Doug.
Thanks for doing a good job, Tom.
Thank you. You got it? Shane has got it? Oh, okay. Yeah, the book was by Ron Suskind. And it's about Paul O'Neill, and it's called The Price of Loyalty. And Paul O'Neill basically told Ron Suskind this. So it's kind of a biography of Paul O'Neill by Ron Suskind, and the title of the book is The Price of Loyalty. Got it, Doug?
Well, he's a good writer. I'll enjoy reading that.
Yeah, he is. And it's a good book. I mean, at the time that it came out, and this was like, you know, 5, 6, 8 years ago, whenever it came out, I read a good chunk of it, and as I recall, we had Ron Suskind on the program, although that's a lot of years ago, so my recollection might be fuzzy. Doug, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for your kind words. Fletcher in Bristol, New Hampshire, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Fletcher, what's up?
Egyptian Book of the Dead. Can I roll quickly? Yeah, there's also the Egyptian Book of the Dead. Courtroom, but they're quite successful for war criminals. And let's see, suicide, I believe, is a mental illness that can be cured. But it's like a cold. You have to let it run its course. You can give it chicken soup or what have you. Tobacco and pot, pure nicotine, touches to your skin, not a needle will kill you. I don't think pure pot will. Someone on a show last night said, use your head, and he's quoting Tim Leary, go out of your mind, use your head.
Right.
He's really condescending, I thought. And I learned most things by talking with people. People say it's a mean old wicked world and nothing is fair. And I'd respond, well, I was fair in love and war. And okay. I think I'm always in love, unfortunately, always at war.
Okay, Fletcher, I gotta thank you for your comments and your concatenation of interesting ideas. Bob in Caspian, Michigan. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Tom, good talking to you again. You were asking about what we do to memorialize this with what Bush has started. And I believe it was illegal, like you said also. And I think that we should, as a nation, boycott the presidential library of George Bush and don't buy any more of his paintings.
I think we should have some sort of a national war crimes tribunal.
If our government won't do it, it would
be great to see some philanthropist fund a venue for this where we can actually have even if it doesn't have the force of law, at least it could have the force of theater, where we could have, and I believe somebody's trying to make a play out of Vince Bugliosi's book, the prosecution of George W. Bush for murder, where we could have, to a certain extent, this is what happened in South Africa, you know, with the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, is that, well, they did have the force of law in that they were able to grant pardons, but they didn't send people to jail. They allowed people to come out and confess their sins, in many cases horrific sins, and then said, okay, you know, go and sin no more. And I think that we, in the United States, we have to get this through. Jerry Ford did a horrible disservice to this country when he pardoned Richard Nixon, not only for the things that we knew about, but for all the things we didn't know about, and he pardoned a whole bunch of people around Richard Nixon, and it was just wrong. And then George W. Bush, and then Bill Clinton essentially pardoned Ronald Reagan, and George Herbert Walker Bush, his not his father, but Bill Clinton's opponent, essentially pardoned them when he became president by refusing to prosecute them for the Iran-Contra scandal. And it's like, these are terrible precedents. And now Obama is pardoning Bush. And it shouldn't be.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, it's been an interesting day. We started out talking with Nate Phelps, who is the son of Fred Phelps, who died today, the Westboro Baptist Church Fred Phelps. Nate Phelps has his own website, Nate Phelps, NateePhelps.com, and his reflections on his father. He said that he left his father's house when he was 18 years old, 35 years ago, and has not talked to his father since then. And he felt that he had already said goodbye to his father, and he didn't expect when his father died that he would be feeling very much emotion, but he is, and it was a very interesting conversation. And from out of that came this whole, a conversation about what is the basis of homophobia. And then, you know, a wonderful African-American woman called in and said, homophobia is too weak a word. You don't call people who hate black people blackophobes. You call them bigots. And like, yeah, okay. Mike Papantonio was with us. He said that, you know, we should figure out ways to start suing the climate change deniers because they are leading us down the road to death and destruction. NASA has now released a report about this. Move to amend. Just send out an email, a mass email. If you're on their list, you probably got it. I just got mine a few minutes ago. About how if, you know, these guys are killing the world and they're doing it because the Supreme Court has said that money is protected by the First Amendment and nonprofit corporations are protected by the 14th Amendment. And we should blow both of those things up with a constitutional amendment. Meanwhile, our young people are drowning in a sea of debt. And that all started with Reaganomics. And, you know, I like to think of Reaganomics as a cancer. Most people don't know that they have cancer, right, until it reaches some later cancer stage. And at that point, depending on how far it's gone, it can be really hard to treat. In the early stages, though, cancer really typically starts out as inflammation. And then a few cells grow slowly but weird initially. These are the cells that they find early on in things like prostate biopsies and pap tests and whatnot. And then the cells begin to rapidly multiply. They become cancerous. Some gene gets flipped on, and that cancer begins to pick up steam. And as it picks up steam, the cancer takes on more and more of the body's resources. It grows and grows and starts stealing all the body's energy and tissues and fluids and building blood cells into itself. And pretty soon, the cancer completely overwhelms the body. And without treatment, the person dies. That's what Reaganomics has done to our economy. That's what Reaganomics has done to the American people. 33 years of Reaganomics, and now we are on life support. Now, you think that's an exaggeration? Ask anybody under 25. Look at the student loan debt crisis in America. Billionaire banksters and billionaire for-profit school operators are making a fortune off America's young people. The average debt for a 25-year-old American student has risen a staggering 91% just over the last decade, and most of that is student loan debt. Over 38 million Americans have outstanding student loan debt right now, totaling over $1 trillion. That's more than credit card, all the credit card debt in America, and all the auto loan debt in America combined. The average is a little more than $23,000 per student. This is nuts. According to a study by Hamilton Place Strategies, by 2023, 9 years from now, the average amount of debt that college students graduate with is going to equal their entire earnings for a year. The median college graduate income for a year, and given that the median income, individual income in the United States right now is in the neighborhood of $22,000, and we have an average of $23,000 in terms of student loan debt. Now, granted, college graduates earn a little more than non-graduates, and that number is an aggregation of everything. We're damn near there. That same study found that average student loan debt at graduation has increased by 200%. Since 1993. 1993 was when Reaganomics moved from being odd cells to being full-blown cancer. And it didn't always used to be like this. Believe it or not, those of you who are younger than 40, maybe you don't. Because you don't remember a time when Ronald Reagan wasn't president or post-Reagan. You don't remember a time when America was operating under an economic system that was not Reaganomics. But there was a time in the United States when the vast majority of college graduates did not leave campus thousands of dollars in debt. College used to be affordable for most Americans, and students could easily work their way through college and fully pay for it. I mean, just ask any baby boomer. Ask anybody over 50. The number of baby boomers with college loan debt when they graduated, it's nothing. Particularly when compared to the number of students in debt today. But then Reaganomics started to kick in the late 80s, early 90s, and everything changed. Price of college tuition has risen more than 1,100% since Reagan's presidency. Back in 1980, the average cost for a year of college was $8,700. And much of that was paid for by a wide variety of government supports and scholarships. As of 2010, the average cost for a year of college is over $21,000, and most of that support has dried up. And as college tuition costs have skyrocketed, more and more American students have found themselves having to take out student loans to pay for a college education. In fact, since the 90s, when Reaganomics was really picking up steam, when that cancer was really growing, cumulative student loan growth, the number of students taking out student loans, is up over 511%. And then it really hit the full-blown cancer stage. I mean, it metastasized after 2000, thanks to George W. Bush, who put Reaganomics on steroids. I mean, even more tax cuts for the rich. Less support for colleges. And so here we have this problem that is almost uniquely American. Because the soaring costs of college and the growing mountains of student loan debt, these are not even an issue in most countries, most developed countries. According to the 2010 Global Higher Education Ranking by Higher Education Strategy Associates, the average total cost of a year of college in Norway, including living expenses, was just over $8,000. Probably most of that is living expense. I mean, what does it cost to live for a year? Same with France and Mexico. In Germany and Latvia, the average total cost of a year of college, including living expenses, $6,000. College education in America used to be that affordable. But Reaganomics changed everything. We need to make college education affordable again. And that, in my opinion, starts with a national debt jubilee. We the people, the government, our federal government should pay off all outstanding student loan debt in the United States right now to zero. It's just over $1 trillion. And our government could easily pay for it. I mean, that's less money than we're paying for either one of George W. Bush's illegal wars. And a clean slate would do wonders for our economy. But more importantly, let's get back to the ideals of Jefferson and Lincoln, who both worked to make a college education free for anyone who's worthy of it. Jefferson started America's first totally free college, the University of Virginia. Lincoln started the land-grant colleges by giving enough land to colleges all across the country that they could use the income from that land to give students free or nearly free tuition. Thomas Jefferson wrote to James Madison, "Above all things, I hope the education of the common people will be attended to, convinced that on their good sense we may rely with the most security for the preservation of a due degree of liberty." And while we're at it, let's ban for-profit schools from getting any kind of government aid whatsoever. That's the type of government welfare that our society really can't afford. And somebody needs to tell Paul Ryan that. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The real welfare queens in America, the for-profit colleges. Kill them off. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Janet in Palatka, Florida. Am I saying that right, Janet?
Palatka.
Palatka.
We're in the north central part of the state.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for calling.
Well, I'm calling about what was discussed your last session about the homosexuals.
Mm-hmm.
My husband was a professor in the sciences, and he had a subscription to the AAAS journal Science, and I used to flip through it trying to find something that maybe I could understand. And I found a study, a very, very short, I guess an abstract kind of thing, in which they had done a rat study and had injected the pregnant mother with extra estrogen. And the result was they followed the male pups, or whatever they're called, as they matured, and they assumed the position of the female rat, which suggests that maybe the sex hormones of the mother at the time of gestation might have something to do with the brain's determination of what you feel you are.
Right. I'm familiar with that research. And in fact, the stuff that followed that research was basically asking this question. If there's a tipping point of maternal estrogen that causes a developing fetus to become a gay person when they're born or when they grow up, is that tipping point within the range of, at the high end of, but within the normal range of estrogen exposures? Because there's such a clear and identifiable subpopulation of gay males, and this research was all done on men, on males, within every mammal, every mammalian species has homosexuality in it. And so is there some tipping point for estrogen? And might there be some similar tipping point for testosterone with regard to the production of lesbians? And nobody knows the answer to that. But the odds are that it's within the normal range of distribution. It's at the high end of the normal range of distribution, which would mean that there is some adaptive value to this evolutionarily, which is why it continues to be passed down, you know, in our genes over the years. But, you know, there's still a lot of head scratching. But the net of it is that people don't decide to be gay or to be straight. They are basically born that way.
Exactly. It seems there's a template or something in the brain, but it seems maybe there's no way to tell. No one has really done a study of what the male to female homosexuals are, but it just seems to me that they're more male. And our society has various chemicals, various foods, various processed foods that have estrogen-like chemicals in them.
Yes. We are surrounded by estrogen mimickers. The bisphenol A and those, that whole collection of compounds, various herbicides and pesticides, particularly the herbicides. The pesticides tend to be neurological disruptors, but the herbicides tend to be endocrine disruptors, and they either are estrogenic or they imitate estrogen and they trigger, you know, basically bind estrogen receptors in the body. or they combine with things that, you know, in the liver will produce things that that are estrogen binding. Yeah, there's a that goes back to the research that was done back 8, 10, 12 years ago, that was looking into why is it that the average age of the onset of menstruation in girls and puberty in boys has dropped by 2 full years over the last 50 years, after apparently remaining stable for hundreds of thousands of years, and it apparently is environmental. Thanks, Janet. Well, last night I didn't tie an arm behind my back, but one of these days I'm going to. It's just going to be tough when I've got Horace Cooper on the panel, because he's really smart. If I'm going to debate conservatives, you know, give me... I should do like Fox, you know? It's like, you know, you're going to have a liberal on, get somebody who's going to be nice and go along, you know? And it's fine with them to get beat up. And instead, we try to find really smart conservatives. Because, I ultimately, and for this program as well as for our TV show, because ultimately I want to have real, genuine conversations that go beyond the bumper stickers. So anyway, but we haven't had such a debate today. I think we will tomorrow. We'll see. I think we've got one lined up. Rolando in Granada Hills, California. Hey, Rolando, what's up?
Thank you, Tom, for giving me the chance to speak.
Sure. Am I pronouncing your name and your city's name correctly?
Yeah, it's correct. It's correct. You know, I want to mention something that you mentioned before about this mass extinction, the Permian that we have. You know, it didn't take 80,000 years to the planet to recover. I studied the stratos, you know, and it took about 10 to 20 million years to recover from mass extinction.
Right. The extinction event itself lasted roughly 80,000 years.
Exactly, but the thing that the people don't realize, there is a study here that entertained some of the Fox people, you know, news that they said that we're going to do something geoengineering. There was a study that took place in 2003, just to move the water that keep the stability of the planet, you know, from the equator in the Atlantic, mm-hmm. it take about to 1 million power plants, 1 million Hoover dams, you know. We don't have those resources now.
Right.
It's better to preserve what we have. Just put your feet in the ground. You know, the science people, they have to realize that we go into mass extinction, and we need to do something quickly and strong, because we cannot let this corporation to destroy the planet just because they want to do. You know, they have their own Wikipedia in the internet, you know, to confuse the people. Mm-hmm. We must to tell the people there is no way to back up. And these changes happen very fast. We have a 10 to the 15 kilograms of methane in the ocean, mm-hmm. and we have 10 to the 18 kilograms of oxygen. You know, if we release this, the 10 to 15 is overcome, because the methane reacts with the oxygen immediately, almost immediately, and react and going to deplete the oxygen levels, you know. If we reduce the from 21 to 19% the oxygen level that we have, we die. The brain cells die. So this is a reality. And
I think we start to die around 15%, because you've got 19% oxygen at about 12,000 feet. But
but point made. Start to die. But the thing is this, Tom. People, you know, I heard that, like, Bill Maher, you know, he's a millionaire. He gave $1 million to the Obama campaign.
Yep.
And we were in the street over here in the Los Angeles, Occupy Movement. We didn't have any $1 million. I mean, we just trying to survive, tell the people the reality about the Wall Street. And we didn't have any kind of help. You know, that $1 million that Bill Maher gave, you know, it's nothing compared with the $1 million the corporation. It didn't do nothing compared with what it could done to the people that we were in the street. So we encourage these people like Bill Gates. We need to have another Roosevelt. I feel that somebody going to come to tell the Roosevelt, you know.
Well, this was the argument that Ralph Nader made in his next to the last book, which was, I forget the title, but I think Only the Rich Will Save Us was the title, or a variation on it. And he basically was saying we need a bunch of progressive billionaires to step up you know, I've been in the room with a bunch of progressive billionaires on a couple of different occasions, and you know, some of them are dancing as hard as they can, and some of them are doing some really good work. But you know, when a progressive billionaire gives $1 million to a progressive cause, they're going to raise their own taxes. They're going to lose not only that $1 million that they gave away, but they're probably going to lose an additional $1 million when their taxes go up. On the other hand, if the Koch brothers give $1 million to a politician, they're making sure that that politician is going to keep their taxes low, and they're probably going to make $2 million back in that that politician is going to reduce the regulations on Koch Industries and on Georgia Pacific and on their refineries and you know, help put in the XL pipeline and all this other stuff. So they're just investing in politics. It's just a business decision. So, you know, Rolando, I'm with you that we've got to do something about this. This NASA study is very alarming. The stuff that Guy McPherson was talking about 2 days ago on this program, very alarming stuff. And we've gone in just a year or two from saying, well, you know, is this or isn't it? And my debating Mark Morano on a regular basis to saying, no, not is it or isn't it, but how bad is it going to get? Rolando, thank you very much for the call. Matt in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. Hey, Matt, thanks for listening to WCPT.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great. You don't want to pay off student loan debt?
Oh, no, I do not.
It's, why?
Well, for a number of reasons. First, the country can't afford it.
Sure,
like
we can.
Where the federal government could.
We're the richest country in the world. We're the richest country in the world. We got plenty of money.
Printing money. More importantly, there's no constitutional authorization for such an expenditure.
Sure there is.
Well, okay, under which clause?
Article 1, Section 8.
Which one?
The very first sentence. The very first sentence. Read it to me, and I'll identify it for you if you have a constitution.
I'm driving. I do know the gist of it. And secondly, on the topic of you continue.
Where's my constitution?
The wars were illegal. Specifically, what laws did they violate to make them illegal?
I'm sorry. Say that again.
Well, you continually proclaim that the two wars were illegal.
Right.
Okay. In order for something to be illegal, there must be a law against it. Specifically,
right.
What laws were violated by those wars? Okay. I don't agree with the Iraq war at all.
Article 1, Section 8, Sentence 11. Congress shall have the power to declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures on land and water. There was no congressional declaration of war, so it was an illegal war, number one. Number two, the first sentence.
There must be a law against something for something to be illegal. You can make the case that it's unconstitutional.
No,
declaring it illegal is intellectually dishonest.
Okay. That's an interesting point. I think that you know, fundamentally it is against the law to lie to the American people. I would have to find the statute, but Vince Bugliosi lays it out in his book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. And you know, I don't have it in front of me, so I can't cite chapter and verse, but your point is taken. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And Article 1, Section 8, Congress shall have the power to collect taxes to provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. So we could do that, pay off our student loan debt. That's Constitution. 28 minutes before the hour, Viagra for your brain, the Tom Hartman Program. Stimulates your thinking, right? It stimulated David's thinking in Germantown, Tennessee. You want to disagree with me, David?
I do. When you said the about the paying off the student loan thing, it struck a chord with me, so I just had to call.
Okay.
Just a quick story. I was in that age group that you said. I'm 37. Mm-hmm. So when all my friends and everything were going to college and they were taking out loans, you know, I did my research, looked at the loans, looked at the job market just like everybody else should have, and decided to go to trade school. Did that. Friends came out. They're super in debt, just like you're saying. That really kind of wrecked their life, a lot of them. And when you go online and you say student debt's a problem, this is a huge problem, it almost like you're leaving out the fact that they took the loans out, like they made a mistake.
I understand.
It was ignorant to do that.
Yeah.
They've got to hold some responsibility. So when you say they're just going to pay them all off, that would, I mean, and I made the other decision along with millions of others not to go to college. I mean, it's completely unfair. Not that everything's got to be a fair guy, but I mean, it just seems backwards. It seems like you're rewarding ignorance. I mean, rewarding stupidity, really.
No, I understand your argument. And it's not that dissimilar from the argument that is made that, you know, we shouldn't feed or house people who are unemployed or people who, you know, in some cases, there's a small subset of our population, maybe 1 or 2%. Who choose to be unemployed, you know, who the surfer bum guy that Fox News has turned into, you know, the national mascot. But I would say to you, yes, it's not fair. And but it's not fair also that you had, you know, an entire generation of young people who grew up, and they're probably younger than you are, who grew up being told virtually from kindergarten, you've got to go to college if you're going to get ahead. It's a whole new world. It's the information economy. We no longer do manufacturing in the United States because we've got these new trade policies that were passed in the 1980s and 1990s, and it's now a global world, and the only way you're going to have any kind of success is going to college. And then when they get of college age, they discover that the only way they can go to college is to go deeply in debt, and they do that in good faith because the economy is rolling along and unemployment's relatively low and jobs are plentiful, not realizing that, you know, right behind the curtain, the banksters are in the process of stealing $18 trillion worth of wealth from all of us and creating this Potemkin village of, you know, an America that looks like it's working when actually they've hollowed it out and stolen all the money. The whole thing crashes in 2008. We're still in the midst of that crash. And these kids, these young people, particularly the ones who are under 25, I don't see them as people who made a stupid decision. I see them as the people who did exactly what they were told to do by their parents, by their society, by their presidents, and pretty much by everybody. And, yeah, it's not fair to people like yourself who chose not to do that, or people like me who I never had any student debt, and I went to two different colleges, not for a real, real long time, or my wife, you know, who actually worked her way through college as a waitress at a Howard Johnson's. Back in the day when you could do that. It's not fair to all of us, but hey, life's not fair. You know, we don't.
Right. Life's not fair, so they should eat.
But it's the best thing for the country, David, is my point. It's the best thing for you and me, even though it's not fair to us, it's the best thing for the country that an entire generation of young people actually have the ability to start buying a house and developing some equity and get a decent job and not be and get married and have families and be invested in society rather than being tied to a debt that, because of the changes in the bankruptcy laws, which, by the way, were advocated by people like Joe Lieberman and our current vice president, that because of these changes in the bankruptcy laws, they can't even discharge through bankruptcy.
Well, like I said before, it's not about fairness. It's about rewarding, you know, it's about...
No, I get your point, but if I could demonstrate to you that this would be the best thing for the country, wouldn't it be worth taking the amount of money that we spent in Iraq for something that, for building our intellectual infrastructure? I think that our intellectual infrastructure is even more important than our physical infrastructure.
Exactly. That's why you don't pay off the debt. You're making everybody stupid.
No. You pay off the debt, and then you make college and trade schools free.
Yeah. No, I'm saying you're giving everyone a mentality that if you make a big, huge mistake, it's okay. You're going to be saved, and that's horrible. I mean, look at the foreclosure. I mean, the people that were responsible with their houses got hurt the worst.
That's
the
right. And it shouldn't be.
Ignorant.
It shouldn't be. It shouldn't be that the banksters. This was not even good for the country, that George Bush twice bailed out the banksters rather than bailing out the homeowners. I think that we should be making the homeowners whole. If we had taken the amount of money that the Fed gave to banksters and rich people during that period from 2007 to 2009, and it was something like $30 trillion in total, if we had taken even a fraction of that money, we could have made whole homeowners across the United States, and we could have let the banks go under, and then smaller community banks would step in to fill that void. So, you know, David, I think we're just going to we're talking in circles here. I respect your point of view. I disagree with it. You know, so we're just going to have to leave it at that. So, Caesar in Chicago, or is it Cesar? Listening to WCPT.
Hey, Caesar.
Hey, Caesar, what's up?
First, I want to say that you're great and you're intellectual, gentlemen. And, you know, even though I get you, I'm very positive. I get what you're saying.
But,
and, you know, we just got to keep on forward. You just got to keep on moving forward. Now, my question was, no, I just want to cover.
Okay.
Now, my question was, what is the possibility that, I've heard this on TV or I've read about this a couple times. What is the possibility that we could have state-run banks? That our banks would be like for Illinois, that would be, you know, Bank of Illinois, and all the profits would go for the state.
They've been doing that in North Dakota, or maybe South Dakota. So I constantly mix up the Dakotas. It's one or the other. They've been doing that in one of the Dakotas since either in North Dakota. Thank you, Jim. since the 19-teens. I think it was 1916, 1918. They started, it was during the Progressive Era, and they started a state bank to help the farmers out because the farmers couldn't get loans from the banks and from the New York banks. And it has worked out spectacularly for that state. That state has had the greatest economic stability of pretty much any state in the union, including during the Great Depression. For all these years, every state should have a state bank, and the only thing that's preventing states from having state banks is the lobbying power of the big New York banks. They buy off not just federal legislators, but state legislators. Illinois should absolutely have a state bank. If Illinois did have a state bank, the hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars that Illinois has on deposit with Chase and Wells Fargo and Bank of America and the other big New York banks, which they have to, because they've got pension funds that have to be deposited. They've got, you know, millions of dollars, probably an hour that they're, you know, the state is doing business. All of that money could be in a state bank, and all the profit that is created from that, which is, I guarantee you, hundreds of billions of dollars, all the profit from that could go right back to the state of Illinois. It could be used to reduce your taxes, or it could be used to give everybody in the state free education. It could be used to build high-speed rail across Illinois. It could be used for a million different things. But, Caesar, you're absolutely right. It needs to be done. There is a piece of legislation working its way through the California legislature to do just this. It's being discussed in the Oregon legislature right now. It needs to be discussed in every state in the country. Stephen, in Lake Worth, Florida. Hey, Stephen, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I've had experiences like when I was 21 years old, I had a four-year-old niece who was struck down by equine encephalitis.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent time babysitting, helping out my sister, you know, both before an event, before and after she was struck down.
Mm-hmm.
And I just couldn't believe that her spirit just stopped, just ended, was done away with.
Yeah.
And that led me to, you know, a lot of introspection. And I finally came across a book called Closer to the Light. It was written by an MD, copyright 1991.
Mm-hmm.
And it's learning from the near-death experiences of children.
Hmm.
And I've also had, you know, very personal experiences. Even when I was put out during a colonoscopy, I couldn't believe that somebody threw a switch and I woke up and it was all over.
Mm-hmm.
I had absolutely no memory whatsoever
of
what had happened to me.
Yeah, they use a super potent benzodiazepine drug that induces amnesia. This is apropos of my conversation 2 hours ago about how Fred Phelps has died, and I believe he's in the light now, that we all go into the light when we die. Good point, Stephen, and thanks for sharing that book with us. I'm with you. Robert in Frankfort, Illinois, listening to WCPT. We got a minute to the end of this segment here, Robert. You wanted to talk about student loans?
Yeah, you know, the caller that was just on, a couple people before me, he was talking about how, you know, if you made a mistake, if you have a student loan, I'm sorry, I'm a medical student. My entire career and everything I'm doing is based on the premise that I'm helping people. You know, if he doesn't want doctors or he doesn't want lawyers, he doesn't want anyone in society, that's fine. Go to Somalia, you know?
Right.
But we have, as a society, we have should have an obligation to, you know, bring out the best in all our students. And I know many people who couldn't go to medical school. You know, I have a couple hundred thousand dollars in debt right
now. Wow, that is so
wrong. Exactly. It's like, you know, it's influencing my choices, too, you know? Like,
yeah.
I want to go into primary care. I want to be an OBGYN.
But you're not going to make the most money there. You're going to make the most money as a plastic surgeon or a brain surgeon.
Exactly. And that's wrong. And that's one of the biggest issues with supporting education.
Yeah.
From the fundamental level, from before kindergarten all the way up to you get your doctorate.
Right.
You know, like, state of California used to do until Ronald Reagan was governor.
That's right. That you're absolutely right. You could become a medical doctor in California when you know, I lived there for a summer in 1968, and a lot of my friends from East Lansing had moved out to California just to get a free education. You're right, Robert. It all started with Reagan. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, both for the state of California and at the federal level, Ronald Reagan put Bill Bennett, the first man ever to say that we should do away with the Department of Education, put him in charge of the Department of Education. Welcome back. John in Wayne, New Jersey, listening to WBAI. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, how are you, Tom?
I'm fine.
I just wanted to chime in on the student loan topic that, you know, has been discussed so far today.
Mm-hmm.
I totally agree with you. I think, you know, the student loan situation, it's terrible. And, you know, you have third world countries in the Middle East and so forth, and they offer free education. And we're the richest country in the world, and, you know, state tuition has been rising every year, state college tuition, while the value of that education is going down because of the job market and these students aren't able to secure jobs.
Yep.
So, you know, I'm a big proponent of, at the very least, having all community college free for everyone in each state, and then heavy discounts, if not, you know, free education at the state college level, and then, you know, let the private universities do whatever they want.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. And I think we should simply have a national statement of oops, right? There's nothing wrong with a country saying, you know, we made a mistake. And this whole Reaganomics experiment, where when Reagan came into office, 80% of the cost of going to college was paid for by federal and state dollars, and only 20% was individual tuition. And so people could work a summer job and pay for the rest of the school year, you know, and they could work they literally work their way through college. It's how it was in America through most of the 20th century until Reagan became president. And now, today, fully 80% of the cost of an education is paid for by the students, and only 20% is federal and state support, the exact opposite, which is why tuitions have exploded. That was a national mistake. We made a horrible national mistake in basically privatizing, corporatizing, and jacking up the price of education, raising the cost of our intellectual infrastructure, and making it available to a smaller and smaller number of people, those people who are wealthy or who are creditworthy, and making it a profit opportunity for our banksters. It was a horrible mistake. We're going to pay off that mistake. Here's $1 trillion. You guys are now free, and starting tomorrow, at the very least, at the community college level and the state college level all across the country, you can go to college for free, just like you could in California before Reagan became governor. And you know, if Harvard wants to charge tuition, that's fine. Everybody doesn't have to go to Harvard.
Right. And kind of another interesting development in the student loan debacle is just similar to how loans were home loans, mortgages were securitized prior to the 07, 08 crisis. Now the new hot kind of securitized product is our student loans.
Right. And, they're basing derivatives on them.
Exactly. So, you know, that shouldn't be the purpose of these loans to begin with. And the fact that private companies and the government itself are earning interest income and there's a higher demand, you know, it's wrong from every perspective you look at it.
It absolutely is. And it only benefits the banksters and the for-profit schools. And schools should not be for-profit. If you're going to start a school, it should be to teach people, not to make a buck. And banks should be public utilities. They should not be profit centers. And you know, we need to roll back everything from the day that Ronald Reagan took office. It's insane what Reaganomics has done to this country. John, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for listening to WBAI. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Harry Reid just sent a letter to Attorney General Eric Holder saying, and I quote, the CIA officials have conducted, quote, a transparent attempt to intimidate the Senate Intelligence Committee and undermine its oversight of the agency. That's mind-boggling. He says, this action has serious separation of powers implications. The allegation that Senate committee staff who have no technical training somehow hacked into the CIA's highly secure classified networks is so absurd as to be comical, says Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. Wow. Gerald in Lake Wales, Florida. Hey, Gerald, you want to talk about bees?
No, it's okay. We know the story of the bees. What I wanted to get to is the federal government makes a profit of $50 billion per year off of student loan debt, if my information is correct.
It is.
Number two is the third leading expense to the federal government. I hope this is not true. Would be the money that has to be paid to service the national debt. And if that's true, I know I'm in trouble.
That probably is true. It's in the neighborhood of $200 billion a year that we're paying to service the national debt. And if interest rates go up, it'll go up substantially.
Is that in your book?
I don't know.
I mean, this is pretty profound. Wouldn't
well,
you?
It's not really. It's as a budget item, it's fairly large. But, you know, the Pentagon budget is three times that. The point is that if we were to expand our economy, if we were to bring our jobs back home, if we were to go back to a rational trade policy, and if we were to allow unions to exist once again, we would not only do away with the annual deficit, but we would begin paying down the national debt really, really, really fast. National debt is roughly 100% of GDP right now. It was 127% of GDP in 1947-48. And how did Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower pay it off? By stimulating the economy, by borrowing even more money and building the national highway system, building schools all across this country, building hospitals. So much of our infrastructure dates back to that period in the late 40s and early 50s because that's what they did, and that's how they paid off the national debt. And we can do it again. So, you know, the fact that we spend a couple $100 billion a year on interest of the national debt, you know, most of that interest is being paid to Americans. It's recirculating in our economy. Only about $3 trillion of the national debt is held by people outside the United States. So it's continuously flowing in the United States. And you keep in mind that federal debt is private savings. So, you know, the national debt is not what you have to worry about. What you have to worry about is the $54 trillion in public debt. Excuse me, in private debt. In debt that is held by individuals, by students, by homeowners, and by corporations in this country. That's the debt that really represents a bomb. Gerald, thanks for the call. Jose in Lancaster, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Jose, what's up?
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I'm calling.
I said good. Thank you.
I'm sorry. I'm calling about what options somebody my age, I'm 23, has aside from taking out student loans to get education or training for a job. Right now, the big pressure from my family and from my peers is go to college, drop everything, go to college. College
sure.
is most important. If I get a job that takes my priorities away from college, my parents have a problem with that. And right
yeah.
now, I have to live with them because I wouldn't be able to work full time to be able to afford to go to college at the same time.
Right. The best advice that I can offer, and that this is just like, you know, life's experience kind of advice, and having been an employer for over 40 years, is that employers don't look at what college you went to. I mean, there might be a few. It might be, you know, Goldman Sachs. They're looking for Ivy League folks, but the vast majority of employers don't care what college you went to. They want to know what your skill set is. Yes, increasingly a college degree has become you know, the equivalent of what a high school diploma was 30 years ago as a, you know, primary barrier to entry into the workforce. But you don't have to go to a fancy college. You don't have to go to an expensive college. You can go to a community college for the first 2 years, you know, a two-year community college, and then spend the next 2 years at a state college or, you know, a reputable institution that doesn't charge an arm and a leg. And there is financial aid available for both those kinds of institutions. Avoid for-profit colleges like the plague, and you know, and don't think that by going to a college that's not Stanford, you're not fulfilling an enormous potential. Most important, cultivate your work ethic. Cultivate, you know, set goals for yourself. Figure out how you want to be in the world and what your real passion is, and then start training yourself in that. You know, do internships, get some real world experience, get out there in the world and show up so that when you do graduate from college and you're knocking on employers' doors, it's not just, hi, I've never been in the workforce. I know nothing about anything except what I learned with this degree. But instead, you can say, you know, I really want to work for you because, you know, I understand your business and I have a passion for your business and, you know, follow your passion. Jose, I'm sorry to not have more time for an in-depth conversation, but we have 1 minute left, and I still have, you know, eight callers on the line here. I want to get at least one more in. Mike in Chicago. Hey, Mike.
Yeah, I'll try to make this quick. This is in regards to the caller from Wisconsin. I want to make sure I understood him correctly, because he seemed to say there was a difference between something being unconstitutional and something being illegal.
Right.
Which lends the question is not the Constitution a legal document?
Yes, it's the highest law of the land.
The law of the land?
Yeah, it's the highest law of the land. Plus, it is against the law to lie to Congress. And the argument that Vince Bugliosi makes in his book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, is that when Bush lied to Congress, he committed a felony. Then he sent people over to Iraq and they died. Death, even if it's like a heart attack by a bank guard during the middle of a bank robbery, somebody dies during the commission of a felony, that's felony murder. Vince Bugliosi is actually calling for the death penalty for George W. Bush. I would not go that far. I think he should be shunned, perhaps imprisoned. And the other people in his administration who participated in this. But it was a crime. Excellent point, Mike. Thank you for calling and making it. I should have picked that up after the break and continued on the rant. So anyhow, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Right? It just isn't. It requires a small d democracy. We're going to take this republic back and make it work. It's going to be all of us, all hands on board. Get out there and occupy something. Get active. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.